Hello and welcome to Reading with Carrie, Stories to Fall Asleep To, a mindfulness podcast series that can be used as a sleep aid or to ease your anxiety and relieve your stress. I am your host, Carrie Fable, and I am so thankful that you've decided to spend some time with me. Wow, we're finally back. It's kind of interesting. So season two ended June 30th of 2021, and this brings about season three, and it is airing June 4th of 2022. The hiatus of a year honestly wasn't planned, but throughout the year, it was coming up in my mind of, do I want to bring this back? How do I bring this back? And it all just kind of culminated in an unexpected way, actually. I'm really excited about how things are set up, and a little bit of me is scared, but I think that's a good thing. I think we should be scared of being ambitious. Speaking of ambitious, I have planned out the episodes, so to speak. I don't have all of the stories chosen, but I do have the base idea for season three, and that is zodiac horoscope signs. Now, before you click away, I am not one of those who really believes in the horoscopes, and I'm not also one who is going to tell you your fortune or say, oh, well, Mercury's in retrograde, so this means that. I don't mean that. I just always like looking for symbolism and inspiration in different ways, and I don't know that anyone has ever done it this way. So you will notice I am doing things a little bit differently than anyone else probably has, and it'll make sense in a moment. So what I've done is collected the 12 zodiac signs as well as the 12 animals of the Chinese zodiac, and I am putting them all together. It's interesting to note what animals they chose. They both actually have goat, and while there are some other animals that are similar in form, a goat is the only one that actually is completely the same animal name. It's also interesting that the zodiac has some non-animals, so that is going to be an extra challenge for me. But essentially, I am bringing up the animal of what the zodiac represents, or the Chinese zodiac, and talking about what it symbolizes, the imagery in different cultures. I will touch very loosely on that, and of course, you can always dig in. I'm just trying to bring in some interest and uniqueness, and I'm going to bring it and try to roundabout it in a way that is crafted for mental health, because that essentially is what this is. This podcast is to help you relieve anxiety, feel a bit better, and either go to sleep or have a nice calm to go about your day. So whenever you listen to this, I am trying to bring some positivity and support. So I did just want to mention, I don't really believe in horoscopes, but I do believe in the 16 personalities of like Myers-Briggs. I believe that there are a set number of personality traits that everyone is unique, but that we share commonalities way more than I think we are led to believe in society almost. Either you fit in this cookie cutter, must like A, B, and C, or you feel like an outcast. And one thing that I've noticed is that we have a lot more in common than we initially believe. So through that mentality, that is kind of why I was looking at the zodiac signs. But really, I just love symbolism and metaphors, and I wanted something to pull from. So the first one, and you will notice I'm going in alphabetical order by the creature. So there is no way that you can guess what I am doing next. Well, I guess there is a way. You can list all 24 animals and see what comes next. But the first one is Archer, and that is the sign of Sagittarius. Now, Sagittarius are born November 22nd through December 21st. So you might know somebody, nice fall weather. And I think that kind of goes nicely with archers, because archers are known for, you know, hunting. Actually, as described by Wikipedia, archery is the sport, practice, or skill of using a bow to shoot arrows. The word comes from the Latin arcus, meaning bow. Historically, archery has been used for hunting and combat, but in modern times, it's mainly a competitive sport and recreational activity. Now the part that I love. Arrows can symbolize many things, from protection and defense to masculine power and warfare, as well as love and movement and direction. And speaking on movement and direction, I looked into it more, and there's actually a parent-child metaphor with the bow and the arrow, illustrating that parents are the bow that merely help the arrow or children fly to its destination. In this metaphor, the archer is God or a higher power, and he is the one who determines the destination of the arrow. But you don't have to be religious or spiritual to interpret this into your own life. Jumping off of that metaphor and the idea of arrows meaning movement and direction, I think we can transform this another way. The archer isn't a person, but rather our passion, our dream. The trajectory lines a path between our dream and the goal. The bow symbolizes the tools and skills we must prepare properly before setting out, and the arrow is the journey. If your dream is misaligned or you are not properly connected with it, you might miss your target. If you don't prepare properly, you don't study and get the knowledge that you need, the bow might snap. And if you lack motivation, the arrow might not have enough power to reach any destination. So that's my thought and takeaway for this. If you were going to apply this analogy to yourself, what would be the archer in your life? What is your passion? What is your dream? Now, this also brings us to the validation space of this podcast, where we myth bust. And so the myth that I'd like to bust, and I will provide a link in the description where I got this myth in fact, people with mental health needs, even those who are managing their mental illness, cannot tolerate the stress of holding down a job. Oof, that's a tough myth. And that is one that I think a lot of us struggle with, the stigma of mental health and mental illness and what that means. But the fact is that people with mental health problems are just as productive as other employees. Employers who hire people with mental health problems report good attendance and punctuality, as well as motivation, good work, and job tenure on par with or greater than other employees. When employees with mental health problems receive effective treatment, it can result in lower total medical costs, increased productivity, lower absenteeism, and decreased disability costs. So, of course, this is looking at it from an employer perspective, but I thought that was really important to kind of bring up, because whether you are battling mental health yourself, or you are considering hiring someone, or have a loved one that you're worried about, this proves that it's not true. Yes, people with mental health and mental illness issues might lack motivation, but the point is that we're trying to show that it's okay to get support. And with the proper support, they can be just as motivated as someone who's not struggling with mental health. Speaking from a personal perspective, I definitely struggle with very low thoughts and lack of motivation, but ironically, I put my value solely in my job. So when I had a job I went to, whether it was retail, food service, or an office job, I took that very seriously. On my day off, I could barely roll out of bed. I would spend every waking day, a waking moment in bed a lot of the times, even back in high school and college. But I always went to school. I always went to my job. I once worked with 103 degree fever until someone could come in and take my shift because there was no one else to run the store, and I took my job very seriously. The problem is that we don't take ourselves and our own needs as seriously as the needs of others and those who are affected. Now, this isn't true for everyone. Again, everyone's journey is different. So some people might not have the motivation to get up and go to a job. And that doesn't mean that they are lazy or their work ethic is any lower than mine. It just manifests in them differently. But the fact is that with the proper support, those suffering a mental illness can still hold a job. Now, how does this relate to archers? I'm glad you asked. So the whole point was motivation and the idea that those who suffer from mental illnesses can't have motivation. But that's not true. You can get it. Now, it's not necessarily an easy path, depending on how your illness or symptoms manifest. But you shouldn't give up on your archer. You shouldn't give up on your passion and your dream. You can send that arrow blazing through the sky and hit your target. And speaking of archers, I can think of no better archer or no better person to represent archers than Robin Hood. So Robin Hood is a pretty large story and it's a book and it's not something that I can read in full on this podcast, but I did want to read a little excerpt. So Robin Hood is by Paul Creswick, and I am going to read chapter 11, in which Robin Hood splits an arrow and learns Marian's name. But first, as always, let's start with a mindfulness meditation. So I'm going to try to do this with you unscripted, and we'll see how this goes. So get into a nice, comfortable position. I've got my arms resting on my knees and my legs crossed. Sitting in a chair, yes, it might be weird. It's how I like to sit in chairs. And so we're just going to kind of connect with where we are in the moment. Notice any areas of strain or stress in the body. Really go through your body from your head, neck, shoulders, down your arms, your elbows, all the way through to your fingertips. And now I'm going to work down my spine. I'm having a bad pain day personally. So I really feel my spine and my hip going down through my knees and my toes. Wiggled my toes. Can't really wiggle them when they're underneath my knees. Now that I've connected with my body, I'm going to connect with the center. And so we're just going to focus on our core. I really focus a little bit higher in my lungs. I imagine my heart. I like to think of the air flowing through my lungs, down my tummy, and out again. So it kind of comes in. And as I hold it, I just feel what it feels like. And then I'm going to release. And I really just feel the warmth radiating down. I really am feeling it in my palms and in my wrists. My fingertips are tingling. I wonder what that's about. Slowly inhale. Connect with your center and really focus. Where does that air go? I can feel it going down my diaphragm into my tummy. There's a tingling warm sensation in my hips where the pain used to be. My head is feeling bubbly as I hear my neighbor clean their car outside. As you connect, just acknowledge when you think something else and come back, just like I did with my neighbor. And we are going to take one more grounding breath in. Hold. And out. Very nice. And now here's the story. Robin Hood and His Adventures, Chapter 11. Profiting by a lesson learned from Willow the Green, Robin stained his face and bade Stutely do the same, ere startling to the royal tourney. The morning was overcast and doubtful when the two lads set forth. They had put on foresters' clothes of green cloth, with long tunics and green trunk hose. Their hands and faces were brown as walnut juice could make them, and whilst Robin carried only his best longbow and a good quiver of arrows, young Will had loaded himself with quarterstaff, axe, and pike, all very difficult to carry. Robin bade him leave one or the other of these weapons, and reluctantly the pike was returned to Warrenton. Then merrily they started away through the forest, and came at noon to that glade where Robin had first met Will o' the Green. Even while Robin wondered whether Will or his men might again demand toll of him, Master Will himself suddenly appeared, and without a word placed his bow across their path.
"Greetings to you, Will," said Robin blithely. "Is it toll of us that you desire?"
"Are you dumb, friend?"
asked Stutely impudently, as the outlaw made no immediate reply. Will smiled then.
"So old Warrenton has persuaded you to seek the prince's gold, youngling?"
said he at last. Without waiting an answer, he stepped back and withdrew his bow.
"Pass then, Locksley, and good fortune attend you,"
he went on.
"May we meet again ere the day be done, but it is not sure."
"You will not try for the purse, Will?" cried Robin, as if surprised.
"I have no use for it,"
answered Will, with some egotism.
"Nay, fear not. Our third trial is yet to come. I did but stay you to speak of your cousin."
He paused and glanced towards Stutley.
"I am deaf and dumb as you were, friend, a minute agone," spoke the little esquire.
"Your cousin, Geoffrey of Montfichet, has gone to France,"
continued Will, speaking freely so soon as Robin had nodded in confirmation of Stutley's discretion.
"Like as not, Master Geoffrey has not talked with you as to his business with us in this greenwood?"
"I know nothing beyond that we did bind my cousin's armor about with red ribbon,"
replied Robin uneasily. He remembered the clerk's warning, and a precedent of coming evil pricked him.
"But I am right glad that Geoffrey has encountered no danger, and has given up his schemes with you." "I did not say that he had done that, Locksley,"
spoke Will in his gruff way.
"Nor do I see why you should fear danger for him when he is in my company."
"I meant not that, Will, believe me,"
said Robin hastily.
"But there are two amongst your band who have little love for my cousin, and are jealous also of you."
And he told him of his adventure in the early part of the day, when they last had met. Will listened with a frown.
"So they winged you, youngling, and yet for all that you won the sheriff's arrow? Give me now some tokens, whereby I may know which of my men are traitors."
"I should only know their voices, Will,"
said Robin regretfully. The outlaw shrugged.
"It matters not after all,"
he remarked, turning to leave them.
"Go your ways, Locksley, and win the purse."
"Is there no tell?"
inquired Robin, smiling again.
"Am I truly free of Sherwood, Will?"
"'Twould seem so, Locksley,"
said the outlaw briefly. Then, without further ado, he strode away from him. They watched his lithe form disappear.
"'Tis sure that our disguise is none too good,"
sighed Robin, pondering upon the ready way in which the outlaw had recognized him. Soon afterward, rain fell and a heavy storm raged amongst the trees. The two youths crept into the hollow of one of the larger oaks to shelter themselves. Whilst waiting there, they heard the noise of an approaching cavalcade. It was a body of archers coming from Lincoln to compete for the purse of gold. They cantered past the tree wherein Robin and Stutley lay hidden, and took no heed of the drenching rain. All were merry with wine and very confident that one amongst them would surely win the prize. The only question was, which one?
"These Nottingham clods,"
cried one scornfully.
"I'll dare swear that many of them have already promised the prize to their maids. Nottingham against Lincoln, 'tis possible that they may stand to us for a round. But after that,
we will spend the money in Nottingham town,"
shouted another of the trotting bowmen.
"For sure the prince himself could do no handsomer thing. A piece I'll toss to the heralds, and another to you, Staveley, for you are a covetous worm."
The rest of his speech was lost through the one addressed turning violently upon him and thrusting at him with his pike, thus tumbling him into the mire. Stutley laughed outright at this, and for a moment startled the rest of this worshipful company. Robin, rather vexed at his esquire's want of caution, came with him from out of the hollow of the tree. The Lincolnshire men halted, and Robin asked for a lift to the field where already the tourney was being commenced.
"Are you going to the Sherwood tourney, and with a bow?"
asked one of the archers loftily.
"What will you shoot there, gypsy boy? There are no targets such as your shafts might reach. But 'tis true that you may learn something of the game if you should go."
"I'll lay a crown wager with you, friends,"
said Stutley, vexed to hear Robin called gypsy,
"that my master's shaft will fly more near the center of the mark than will any one of yours. So now,
A crown piece, Gypsy? Why, that means 20 crowns for you to find,
laughed another of the men loudly.
20 crowns? Why, he has not 20 pence,
said another. My man has laid the wager, and I will stand to it, said Robin quietly, though I do not like such boasting. I promise you, 20 crowns to 20 crowns. Who will hold the stakes? Here is my purse in warrant of my words.
Why, master, I am surely the very man to hold your purse,
called out the lately fallen champion, readily.
Ask any of them here, and, if they have love of truth in them, they will say that Much the Miller is a man of men for honesty, sobriety, and the like. 'Tis known throughout Lincoln that never have I given short measure in all my life. Hand me the purse, and be easy.
Show me your crown, friend, said Robin, eyeing him.
Now stir up me, but I have given my last piece to a poor beggar whom we did meet in the wood.
Then I will hold my purse myself, Master Much, cried Robin, putting it quickly back into his bosom. But have no fear. If you can beat me, I'll add my crown to the prince's money bag. We will meet you here, friends, he continued, beside this very tree, at noon tomorrow, if I should win. If not, I'll yield this purse to the miller ere I leave the tourney, and he shall share it round. Is it agreed?
I do think you should pay for your traveling, Gypsy, since you are so rich,
grunted the first archer.
Here's half my saddle. I'll only ask a silver penny for a seat on it. I'll take you for naught, Gypsy,
shouted Much, who really was very tipsy.
You've spoken fair, and I like you. Come, jump up behind me and hold tight. This horse is one of most wayward character. Hurry then,
said the leader.
Whilst we chatter here, the tourney will be done, and we shall happen upon it just as Hubert takes the prize. Forward, friends, quick march.
They rattled off at a smart pace. Robin mounted behind the good-natured Much, and Stutely upon the captain's horse. The miller told Robin confidentially a full score of times that he, Much, was bound to win the archery contest, being admittedly the first bowman in the world.
Hark ye, Gypsy,
called he at length, over the point of his shoulder, to patient Robin behind him.
I'll not take your crown, I swear it. I like you, and I would not rob your sweetheart of a penny piece. Buy ribbons for her, then, with the crown I give you.
Robin expressed his thanks very cordially. This fellow seemed an honest-hearted rogue, and 'twas mainly to his furious urging of his steed that they arrived in time for the great event. As it was, all the jousting was done, and most of the nobles had already gone away. The sheriff was fussily preparing himself to escort the prince to the castle, when the horns blew, announcing the arrival of the Lincolnshire bowmen. They had pushed their way clumsily through the array of tents, and now blundered into the lists through the gate. Robin was glad indeed of his stained face and semi-disguise, not being over-proud of his companions. He gave Will Stutely a signal to detach himself from them and come to his side. The two youths then hastened to the archer's stand. There had been 3 deaths already as a result of the joustings, and 6 others were seriously injured. Yet the prince looked far from being satisfied, and his glance strayed forever to the gate. When the Lincoln men had come nosily trooping in, his face had lit up, and his hand had made a half-movement to find the jeweled hilt of his sword. Master Carfax, too, had started to his feet in evident concern. When the heralds announced these newcomers, visible disappointment showed on the faces of the prince and his followers. Clearly they were eagerly expecting the appearance of other folk. But quickly recovering himself, John refound all the old elegance of his manners. He courteously acknowledged the rough greeting of the archers, and sat back smiling in his box. Master Monceux gave the signal for the archery contest to be begun, and Robin soon saw that the archers against him were men very different from those who had been at Nottingham Fair. When it came to the turn of the prince's own bowman, Hubert of Normandy, a man slim, conceited, and overdressed, but nevertheless a very splendid archer, the first shaft flew so cleanly and so swift that it pierced the very middle of the target and stuck out on the other side full half its length. Robin had to shoot immediately after him, and waited a few moments whilst the markers were tugging at the Norman's arrow. A sudden inspiration flashed across the lad's mind, and, advancing a step, he bade them desist. They wonderingly fell back, leaving Hubert's arrow fixed spitefully on the target. One of the heralds cried out that this archer had not yet given in his name, but even as he spoke, Robin's arrow flew hissing from his bow. A silence fell upon the onlookers, and even the smiling prince leaned forward in his box. Then a great shout went up of amazement and incredulity. The markers and heralds thronged about the target and hid it from the general view until they were impatiently pulled away by some of the prince's bodyguard. A marvel was seen then by all eyes. Robin's arrow standing stiffly out from the center of the target, with Hubert's wand split down on either side of it, flush to the very face of the mark. Robin himself could scarcely credit his own success. He had done the thing before, with Warrenton, once out of 12 times, and he had essayed it now more out of bravado than aught else.
"'Twas a feat worthy of Hubert himself,"
said the sheriff, bombastically, to the prince. He had not recognized Robin.
"I have seen Hubert perform just such a trick on many occasions, sir,"
said Carfax.
"This fellow has done no uncommon thing, believe me,"
he went on.
"And after all, he has not bettered Hubert's shot."
"That is true," said the prince, as if thoughtfully. His face showed smiling again. "Let the contest go on, and Hubert shall shoot again with this young trickster."
"The heralds say that he has not given in his name, sire,"
said one of the courtiers.
"If that is so, his shooting is of no avail. It will never be so good,"
cried Fairfax triumphantly.
"Tell them that the archer is disqualified, my lord,"
he continued, addressing the sheriff,
"and bid them discover who he may be."
Carfax turned again to the prince and began a whispered conversation with him. The prince listened, nodding his head in approval.
"Well, Monceux, what do you say?"
he asked the sheriff languidly, as the other returned.
"It seems, sire, that the usher is one who came in with a company of Lincoln bowmen. No one knows him whereabout. I have said that he is disqualified, and now the others will shoot again. But Hubert has now the purse, for sure."
"In sooth, I do think so,"
answered the prince, laughing rather conceitedly.
"But Monceux, bid this lad to me forthwith. I would speak with him."
The sheriff went about the task, but Robin had disappeared, for suddenly, amidst the throng, his eyes had encountered those strange gray-blue ones of Mistress Fitzwalter. She was sitting alone in a little box nearby the targets. Robin had walked down the lists to see for himself that his shaft had split the Normans fairly, and in turning away to find Stutely, he had become aware of her shrewd, piercing gaze. She allowed her eyes to rest fully on young Fitzsooth's ardent glance for the briefest moment. Then she looked away unconcernedly. But Robin, venturing all, drew nigh. He came to the edge of her box and began to speak. He had gone so far as,
"Give you good morrow, lady,"
when his eyes perceived the sheriff's little golden arrow fastening her cloak. His mouth became dry at that, and his words went back in his throat. The girl, aware of his confusion, brought her gaze back upon him. She smiled.
"Is it indeed my young champion?" asked she,
rather doubtfully at first, in her low, soft tones.
"Is it you who have beaten the prince's best archer, Robin of the Hood?"
Her eyes were wells of innocent fun. The way in which she lingered over the last syllable brought Robin still deeper into the deep waters.
"It is your servant, madame,"
was all that he could find to say.
"You see, then, that I wear your gift, Robin," she said,
trying to make him at ease.
"I have not forgotten."
"Nor I. I shall never forget,"
cried he impulsively.
"Your eyes are always in my memory. They are beautiful as stars,"
he said fervently.
"Oh, a gallant Locksley. But there, take my colors, since you will be my knight."
She untied a ribbon from her hair and gave it into his outstretched palm.
"And now, farewell. Take the prince's prize and spend the pennies worthily. Buy your sweetheart some ribbons, but keep that which I have given you."
She tossed her curls again as she added the last word. Robin was beginning a vehement protestation that he had no sweetheart when Stetley's voice broke in upon him.
"Master, they have disqualified you and given the prize to Hubert. 'Tis a vile injustice, and I have raised my voice furiously. So, alas, has Master Much the Miller. He is a very worthy gentleman."
"What do you say?"
asked Mistress Fitzwalter in amazement.
"It is even so, lady, that my lord the sheriff has ruled my master out of the court, for the reason that he did not give in his name before drawing his bow," cried Stutely. "A wicked conspiracy it is, and monstrous unjust. 'Tis thus that these prizes are given. The game's arranged beforehand. Ah, but I know how these Nottingham folk do plot. Thrice now I have found them false and treacherous."
When Stutely had begun, there were many who were ready to side with him, but his unlucky conclusion turned these possible friends into enemies. Even Mistress Fitzwalter drew back for an instant.
"Be silent, Will,"
said Robin, vexed at once.
"It is enough to be juggled out of this prize without you making it worse. I'll go claim it with Monceux, and he shall argue it with me."
"The prince is asking for you, friend,"
said Carfax, suddenly appearing. He touched Robin on the shoulder. As he turned to depart, his gimlet eyes saw how the girl shrank away from them into her box. He looked swiftly at her, then at Robin again.
"His Highness graciously condescended to inquire your name and rank,"
he said, pausing.
"Will he give the purse to me, then?"
asked Robin, surprised.
"Nay, that has already been won by Master Hubert,"
answered Carfax, as if amused at the question.
"You cannot win a prize every day, Master Locksley."
He spoke at a shrewd guess, and saw that his shaft had hit the mark. Mistress Fitzwalter's interest in Robin had given him the clue.
"I'll not go to the prince,"
said Robin wrathfully.
"Tell him, Master Fetch and Take, that I have won this prize, in all fairness, and I will shoot with Hubert again, if he needs another beating."
"You'll cool your heels in the stocks, Locksley,"
said Carfax, viciously.
"So much is evident. The sheriff has a quarrel with you already, and 'tis well that you are here to answer Master Ford's complaint. The prince will send for you in style, since you will not go kindly to him. Bid but a few minutes. I'll not keep you waiting."
He strode off in heat, followed by Stetley's scornful jibbings. Robin became aware that the people were eyeing them both with none too friendly glances. He felt that he and Will
Colonel Stutley, were in a difficult position. Escape seemed to be out of the question.
"Jump over the ledge of my box, Robin," whispered a sudden small voice, "and so make your way through the door at the back of it. Hasten."
Gratefully, Robin did as she bade him, and Stutley, without waiting for invitation, followed. Mistress Fitzwalter instantly opened the door for them.
"Hurry, I pray you," cried she. "I see them coming for you both. The prince has sent his pikemen."
Robin pushed Will out before him, and turning, caught her little hand in his.
"Thanks, thanks," he muttered hurriedly, and strove to kiss her fingers.
Laughing and blushing, she snatched them away.
"Go,"
she cried in agitated voice,
"and stay not until you reach Loxley. We may meet again to talk of thanks," she added, seeing that he still hesitated.
"Give me at least your name,"
panted poor Robin at the door.
"Not that I shall ever forget you."
"I am called Marion," answered she, closing the door ruthlessly upon him. "Marion Fitzwalter, now go, I implore you, and may good fortune be with you always."
Thank you for listening. If you would like to support this podcast and become a sponsor, you will find an Etsy link in the description below. Thank you for your consideration. I welcome you back anytime you may need to hear a comforting voice or a familiar bedtime story.